1 Samuel 29. And our theme this evening is the Lord's abounding grace to David and his people. The Lord's abounding grace to David and his people. We've already seen how David has got himself into a fearful mess through unbelief and deceit. We saw that in chapter 7. You see how the narrative is moving back and forth from David to Saul and now back to David again. So in chapter 27 we saw that he had befriended Achish, the king of Gath, and as a result, even though he was a child of God, he is playing in the role of an apostate opposing the Lord and his people. So that brings us firstly a spiritual anomaly. A spiritual anomaly. In the first two verses, now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed on in the rearward with Achish. Achish was at the rear with David and his men. Achish was the overall commander of the Philistine army. But we find David in this bizarre role, acting as an enemy of the Church of God, ready, at least in terms of profession, to take up arms against the Israel of God. But notice there's something worse. He is not on his own. Because of his prominent position as a leader in Israel, as the future king, others are with him. And so we read of his men also, and we know from chapter 27, verse 2, that there were 600 that were with him that went to Achish. So, as well as David posing as an enemy of the Lord and his people, in order, as he thought, to save his life, there are 600 other Israelites doing the same thing and playing the same game. Compromise is always wrong, but all the more so when it is in those who are meant to lead the people of God in the way of truth and of righteousness. So is a well-known example in Galatians and chapter 2. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 11. But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed. For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. And when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, If thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? So there Peter had compromised. The Judaizers were corruptors of the gospel. They were insisting that Gentile converts should not only be circumcised, but conform to Old Testament ceremonies. And what was at stake was not simply a matter of these ordinances, but the very gospel itself, that they were necessary to salvation. And Peter, because of fear of these people, compromised and separated from the Gentiles, and others followed him. We see, we read there of others to the extent that even Barnabas followed him. See verse 13, and the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. So Peter compromised, other Jewish believers compromised, and the pressure was so great even Barnabas compromised. So Paul rebuked him publicly for playing the part of an enemy of the gospel. He wasn't an enemy of the gospel, but in compromising in this way, he sided with those who were opposing the gospel. And he succumbed to pressure from those who were corrupting the gospel message. You remember the apostle's instructions in 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy and chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 19. Against an elder, receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses. Then that sin, rebuke before all, that others also may fear. So the elders are to have particular protection against false accusation. But once having established that they've gone astray, then their rebuke is to be a public one. And so the sins of leaders are greater than the sins of followers. Whoever compromises a principle, biblical principle, has sinned. But those who are meant to be examples and leaders to the people of God, when they do it, their sin is greater. And it is a public matter and to be treated accordingly. So David was to be blamed. He was to be blamed for his conduct and for the effect of his conduct on others. And the Lord could have justly left him in this fix, this mess that he was in. But in abounding mercy, he delivered him. For his name is Jesus, and he shall save his people from their sins. And he does not suffer his people to be overwhelmed by sin indefinitely. The encouragement here is not to presumption and to presumptuous sin. It is not telling us that we can do whatever sin we like and we know that the Lord will preserve his people. A true Christian will not say that. What shall we say? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. How then shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? But even when our own sin does get us into a corner, we must cry to the Lord for deliverance. We're not told what David was doing spiritually at this time, but we are being told that we are not to think that when our own sin gets us into trouble, that the way to the Lord, or the way back to him, the way of access, is closed. It is not. We must not conclude that since we got ourselves into the jam by our sins, we must get ourselves out, and if we can't, then he can't, or he won't. He is gracious and of great kindness. I think we've all probably been in those terrible situations of our own making, when we've compromised, we've sinned, and we're in a jam because of what we've done, and we can't see any way out. There's the ghastly weight upon our conscience, as well as the inability to see a way out that is anything other than a complete disaster. And I reckon most of us have been in that kind of situation where the possible roots are all ghastly, where we compromise principle. We don't know whether to admit it to the ungodly, and yet we can't see any way out. The Lord deals kindly even with erring children. And even in our own troubles, when they're our own doing, we must still turn to him, because he is gracious and ready to forgive. Secondly, we have in this passage a blessed enmity. A blessed enmity. Verse 3. Then said the princes of the Philistines, what do these Hebrews hear? And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which hath been with me these days or these years, and I have found no fault in him since he fell unto me unto this day? these days, these years. He was, this time he was with Achish for a year and 4 months, but he had previous contact with him, of course. But the lords of the Philistines take a different approach. Verse 4, and the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him, and the princes of the Philistines said unto him, make this fellow return, that he may go again to his place which thou hast appointed him, and let him not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us. For wherewith should he reconcile himself unto his master, should it not be with the heads of these men? So they take a very different view of the situation. There is their distrust in verse 4. They thought that they'll just get into the battle and David will change sides. After all, what better way to regain the favor of Saul than to suddenly turn around, fight against the Philistines at the critical point in the battle, and bring Israel to Saul, bring victory to Saul and to Israel? In point of fact, there is no reason to think that Saul would even have turned from his enmity to David had he done so. And it may be that David would have done that. We just don't know. The man was in such a fix here that what could he have done? But at any rate, these lords of the Philistines didn't think he'd really changed. They thought when it came to it, he wouldn't fight against his fellow Israelites, and he'd try to win Saul's favor at the expense of the lives of the Philistines. And then there were their memories. Verse 5, is not this David, of whom they sang one to another in dances, saying, Saul slew his thousands, and David his 10,000? They remembered when David had behaved according to his true state of heart before God, when he fought on the Lord's side, and when he fought for the Lord's glory, and he fought against the Lord's enemies. No, they thought, he hasn't really changed. And they were right. They were actually right. Although David was in a somewhat backslidden and declined spiritual state, and in a compromised situation, they were right. He hadn't really changed. And they all unwittingly testify to the truth of the perseverance of the saints. They didn't think he'd changed, and fundamentally he hadn't. God had begun a good work in him. It could never be eradicated. He belonged to the Lord, and the Lord's people were his people. But notice here, their enmity was of much greater help to David than Achish's friendship. Their enmity, although they didn't intend it, was of much greater help to David than Achish's friendship. This in two aspects. Firstly, directly, in that their attitude made David feel the enmity of the world. It must have stung David with the folly of what he had done, of thinking that he could really be at one with the Philistines in some way. Achish's friendship was a snare. Their enmity, though sinful, reminded David of his true position. It reminded him of the hostility between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, and that he was altogether in the wrong place. And sometimes we have to be stung by the world in order to be reminded of the futility of seeking the popularity of the world. And the Lord in his providence sometimes causes us to feel that when we've tried to be too clever, and at expense of principle we've kept in with the world, and then it turns sour and we find that the friendship we thought we achieved, and that cordial relationship with the ungodly that we thought by our wits we had brought about, that it turns into ashes in our mouth, and they we're stung by their hostility. In the Lord, in his kindness, is making us feel the futility of seeking to obliterate or to blur the distinction between the people of God and the world. And then also, a second aspect of this, in providence, it was the hostility of the lords of the Philistines that got his hold from which no friend could have extricated him. The Lord used this hostility of the lords of the Philistines to David, their memory of his better days, and their distrust that he had really become one of them. The Lord used that to bring David out of this quagmire that no friend could have got him out of. The Lord used wicked men. The Lord does use wicked men. He used wicked men, the supreme example, in the death of his son on the cross, to accomplish redemption for his people. He used wicked hands. He used Judas. He used the chief priests and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the elders. He used the Romans. He used Pilate. He used Herod. He used the devil himself to bring about his glorious purpose of redemption in Christ Jesus. He used the pagan mariners to remind Jonah of his duty. Jonah 1:6, when they woke him up and they said, "Awake, thou sleeper, and call upon thy God." He used Cyrus the Persian to deliver his people from and to cause Jerusalem to be built. Isaiah 44:28, that saith of Cyrus, "He is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure," even saying to Jerusalem, "Thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid." The Lord used Cyrus to cause his temple to be built. And he uses these lords of the Philistines to get David out of his self-made jam. What glorious providence! All things working together for good to them that love God and who are called according to his purpose. Even the sins of the ungodly, even the malice of the lords of the Philistines working for David's good. Ephesians 1 and verse 22. "And he hath put all things under his feet and gave him to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all." That's speaking of Christ, and the church is his body, the fullness, the completeness of him that filleth all in all. That Christ, as the Redeemer, is, although independent of all, is in another sense, as far as the purpose of God is concerned, incomplete without his body, the church. And he is head over all things to the church, in the interests of the church. And so we have a lesson here. Do not complain when the world is hostile to you. I know that's easier said than done, but we should not complain when the world is hostile to us. The Lord will do us good through the hostility of the world. Luke 6 and verse 26 tells us that some measure of hostility is inevitable. "Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets." It was well for David that not everyone in the Philistines did speak well of him. Achish thought he was great. The lords of the Philistines didn't. And it was well it was so. John 15 and verse 19. John 15 and verse 19. "If you are of the world would love his own. But because you are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you." So if we suffer for righteousness' sake, we are blessed indeed. And the Lord will do us good, even in this life, through the hostility of the ungodly. And he did with David. It was through this means that he both stung David and also providentially delivered him from his dreadful position. And so we have, thirdly, a blessed separation. A blessed separation, verse 6 onwards. Achish is outvoted. The Lord of the Philistines evidently had some powers of veto and check upon his government of them. And he professes what a consistent job David had done in his service of him. Verse 6, Achish called David and said unto him, surely as the Lord liveth, thou hast been upright, and thy going out and thy coming in with me in the host is good in my sight, for I have not found evil in thee since the day of thy coming unto me unto this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's favour thee not. Achish bears testimony to the consistency of David's pretense. He didn't know it was pretense, but it was. And so he says, he found no fault, but the lords of the Philistines did. David, now, after a year and 4 months, according to chapter 27, verse 7, is quite an accomplished pretender. David was a very able man, a very gifted man, a very intelligent man, and he was able to pretend very well. And he plays the part of the loyal and therefore hurt and wounded subject of Achish. Verse 8, David said unto Achish, but what have I done, and what hast thou found in thy servant, so long as I have been with thee unto this day, that I may not go fight against the enemies of my lord the king? He's pretending to be hurt, and yet he must have been overjoyed to be released from his predicament. Achish praises David, praises him, and calls him as one who has been like an angel of God in verse 9. But he feels powerless, and so David and his men must go. And so David is delivered and is blessed with separation from Achish. There is a lesson here. We cannot deliver ourselves out of the world. We cannot remove ourselves from this world, nor should we try. But we should be wary of the world's favors, and in what way we may put ourselves under obligation to them. Think of Abraham and the king of Sodom in Genesis 14. Genesis 14 and verse 21. And the king of Sodom said unto Abraham, after the battle of the kings, and Abraham had helped him, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. Save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Anna, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their portion. There ought to be a carefulness amongst the Lord's people that when they accept favors from the ungodly, that they do not put themselves under some seeming obligation that they will later find difficult to fulfill, and yet difficult to withdraw from. And we should avoid unlawful alliances. They are no blessing at all in the long run, and they're not easily got out of. And if the Lord hadn't wonderfully delivered David out of this predicament, it's difficult to see how he would ever have got out of it. So we need to be careful. Fourthly, abounding grace. Abounding grace. In the next chapter, we look at it more fully, God willing, next time. But in verse 1 and 2, and it came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag, and burned it with fire, and had taken the women captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away, and went on their way. So the Amalekites had attacked Ziklag and taken David and his men's wives and children with them, presumably to sell as slaves or whatever. The Lord, through the lords of the Philistines, was not only delivering David from his predicament, but getting him back in Ziklag in time to see what had happened and to rescue the women and children who had been taken captive. You see, the Lord's grace toward his people is all embracing. We're not like that. Even when we do seek to do good to others, if there's several problems, we go for the best option because we're limited. We're one thing at a time, people. But the Lord's grace to his people takes account of all that is going on, always and in all things. He has the whole business before his mind. And so he uses this hostility of the lords of the Philistines to bring David, like the prodigal, to himself. And so in the next chapter, in verse 6, we read, "And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God." So the Lord, through the lords of the Philistines, got David out of his predicament, got him back to Ziklag in time to do something about their families having been taken by the Amalekites, and appears also to have used it for the spiritual awakening and reviving of David in the ways of the Lord. God is not a one thing at a time God in his gracious dealings with us. He is doing us good in all the effects and connection of what he does to us with all that is going on around us. And you see here too how the Lord preserves his servant and causes him to persevere. He preserves and he causes to persevere by measuring temptation so that there is always sufficient grace to prevent, if not all backslidings, yet to prevent apostasy. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians 10:13. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it." And the meaning surely is that the Lord measures the temptations and the trials of his people so that they never exceed the grace that he gives to preserve them from apostasy. In Psalm 125 and in verse 3, "For the rod of the wicked shall not rest upon the lot of the righteous, lest the righteous put forth their hands unto iniquity." Now the meaning there is that the Lord will not suffer the rod of the wicked to go on and on resting upon the lot of the righteous to the point where the righteous deny the faith and stretch forth their hands to iniquity. In other words, he preserves and causes to persevere his saints. He preserves and keeps the feet of his saints so that they are not overwhelmed in their trials. He measures the trial and the temptation and ensures that there is grace sufficient to meet the trial to the extent of preserving his people from apostatizing from the truth. But then fifthly, we have in this passage grace to Israel. Grace to Israel. With the preservation of David, both physically and spiritually, was bound up the Lord's grace to his church as a whole. David was to be the light of Israel. When Saul was removed and it was imminent, David would reign in righteousness, because the Lord, who had abandoned his people for a moment, was going to return in mercy and loving kindness to them. And the Lord was preserving David in body and soul for his calling to be the Lord's anointed the king of Israel. And so he was showing kindness through these lords of the Philistines, not only to David, but to the people of God as a whole. And he was also preserving his own promise that of the seed of the woman and from the loins of David would come the Redeemer of God's elect. So again we see the complexity of God's purpose, and yet the single-mindedness of God's purpose in his grace to his people in all directions, working all things together for their good. There is a complexity and there is a simplicity in the purpose of God. The intricacy is complex beyond our understanding, and yet there is a simplicity in that all in all its complexity it is working for the good of the people of God. And so God was doing good to David. He was doing good to his people in David, and above all he was preserving his promise in David that the Redeemer would come. Oh, the depths of the wisdom and knowledge of God.